This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This week, NPR listeners nationwide will examine this question. What is America's role in the world? It's part of NPR's election year project called A Nation Engaged, examining how voters are feeling about some pretty weighty issues. And few subjects are weightier than foreign policy, especially in the U.S., arguably still the most powerful nation on earth. So today in The Exchange, we dig into this debate with you. What part should the U.S. play on that global stage? What kind of an actor should this country be? Give us a call. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for the hour. Wayne Lesperance is here, interim dean of undergraduate programs and a professor of political science at New England College. And Wayne, thank you for coming in the week before school gets started. We really appreciate you taking time out.
Thanks, Laura. Good morning.
Also with us, Andy Smith, director of the UNH Survey Center and an associate professor of political science at UNH. And Andy, same deal. We know you're busy. Thank you for being here.
Happy to be here.
Well, Andy, putting on your pollster hat for a moment, please. How do you gauge how people feel about this very big question? You know, what is America's role in the world? How do you even begin to ask the right questions that help you figure that out?
Well, I think that the key there is to say, how do you ask the right questions? Because if you think about the America's role in the rest of the world, it's multifaceted. You've got trade issues, you've got security issues, you've got ideological issues that have come up and down throughout the last 100 years or so. So it's very difficult to reduce that to a single question or even a series of questions. What pollsters often do is ask questions about, you know, the more generally the perception that the U.S. should be more engaged or less engaged. Should we deal more with what goes on in the rest of the world or pay attention to our own backyard? And that's also a difficult thing to assess because people don't often see the benefits of engagement, but they certainly see, you know, what's going on in their backyard. Because the United States is a big country, lots of people. We really don't get out much in the world. maybe to Canada if we live in New England. But for the most part, we stick with what's going on at home. And it's difficult for most Americans to really understand things that are going on in the rest of the world, you know, trade issues that are coming up right now, unless you see something bad happen. And then when bad things happen, we pay attention.
So the question, one question that you can ask, Andy, is should the U.S., quote, deal with its own problems and let other countries deal with theirs? That's one survey question that I've seen.
Right. And there's been questions like that have been asked by the Gallup organization, by Pew, and then by political scientists for years. But then again, that's a very difficult question because you could certainly answer yes to both of those. We should pay attention to what's going on at home, but we also need to pay attention to what's going on in the rest of the world. But again, most people don't know what's going on in the rest of the world. They don't know the problems that many countries are facing at home. They don't understand that the issues and interests of those people in those countries don't necessarily line up with our own interests in the United States. And it's almost asking people in the country too much to get themselves up to speed to be able to answer those questions. And that's why this becomes such a difficult thing for voters to suss out during an election campaign, because things are reduced to sound bites anyway. So we're taking what are already very, very complicated issues with tremendous amount of knowledge that's required and reducing it to, yes, we should do more, or no, we should do less.
Yeah. What do you think, Wayne? How do we even figure out how people feel about this, what America's role in the world should be?
Well, and I think Andy's got it exactly right. We really don't pay attention until something very bad happens, and that's unfortunate. I think there's a false distinction that gets perpetuated, I should say, that there is over there and then there's here, and as if they're separate things. What happens over there, wherever that is, affects us very much here, whether it's the opioid crisis, whether it's terrorism, whether it's jobs, loss of manufacturing jobs. All of these things are interrelated. We really are an interdependent society. world in which decisions that are made far away from us can affect us. So we ignore the world to our own detriment, at our own peril, and only tune in when something very bad happens, which tends to color then our perception of what's going on out there and what role we should play. I think we are way too used to seeing American foreign policy being measured in terms of boots on the ground or responding to some sort of a crisis. They're very real, and often it requires an American response. But if that's our relationship with the world, then you can understand why folks don't really want to tune in. It's not a whole lot of, there's not a whole lot of good news. So I think pollsters have a terribly difficult job here trying to really get a sense for how much do Americans know about what's going on in the world and whether or not they really ought to care.
The phone number for you to join us on that question: what is America's role in the world today, especially as we approach this big election in the fall, is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So Wayne, Andy mentioned this. A recent Pew survey finds Americans worry of global involvement. 57% saying the U.S. should, quote, deal with its own problems and then let other countries deal with theirs. How typical is that, Wayne, of American sentiment?
I think that's sort of the new normal, although if you look further in that poll, the trend is moving the other way. So I think it was 3 years ago, 51% said that the U.S. does too much in the world, and that number's down to 41%.
That's a big shift.
That is a big shift. I'll defer to my colleague who's the pollster to tell us how significant that is. But I think it is significant. I think what it says to us is, particularly in a presidential election year, we're paying more attention, but we're also seeing things. If you think about over the last year, the images of a place like Paris of terrorist attacks, we've seen this terrorist threat sort of metastasize in the form of ISIS and other challenges around the world. I think Americans are beginning to sort of inch again towards the idea that, you know, the U.S. is an indispensable power in the world, and we can't walk away from some of these challenges.
Well, we see these trends in American history, right, Andy? Isolationist versus interventionist. You know, you can look back pre-World War I, pre-World War II, and so on and so forth.
Well, that's actually absolutely the case. You can go back to Washington's farewell address when he talks about dangers of foreign entanglements. And there's been that, what we call an isolationist trend, but I think it was more the defend ourselves trend in America, which I think underlies American public opinion on what we should do in the world. And you've seen that go up and down, but it's usually in relationship to major foreign events. So we saw a push for isolationism post-World War I, which is a devastating war, far more in Europe than it was here. But we were saying, why are we involved in Europe in this mess that they've got there? Let's stay back home. So there was a push there. After World War II, there was definitely a push in the United States and by the leadership there to get more engaged and create the sort of a alliance system and financial system that we have right now. But that was a really, really unique thing. The United States at that time was by far the greatest military and economic power on the world. The rest of the world had been devastated. So we had about 20 to 30 years where we were the king. Nobody else was even close to the United States. So we started to think of the world that way. Vietnam knocked us down certainly a peg, and there was a push to isolationism there. The war in Iraq, and I think one of the reasons Wayne points out that those numbers declining or increasing about U.S. involvement, as we get further and further away from the war in Iraq, people kind of forget about that. And they say, yeah, maybe we should get involved. But when we have bad foreign events that we're, that the U.S. is engaged in, that's when we want to pull back. So by 2004, 2005, there was strong sentiment to pull back, get out of Iraq. And Barack Obama largely won in part the presidency in 2008 because he was tapping into that sentiment.
Oh, that's a good point. And it's worth remembering because against Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama did put out, Wayne, this very sort of let's deal with our problems at home, let's get out of Iraq, let's winnow down our forces in Afghanistan. And that was a popular message back in 08.
It was a winning message back in 08, right? That was where Hillary Clinton was really caught, I think, surprised to some extent that message was resonating more and more with American people. And Andy's right. The public opinion had shifted in a way that had seen a lot of war in a very compressed amount of time, and the American people began to increasingly focus back home. Think back to President H.W. Bush going from, I forget the numbers, high 80% approval ratings in the aftermath of Desert Storm to losing his reelection bid, right? It's the economy, stupid, was the line. The focus back to domestic politics. So these cycles of up and down are very much a part of our political landscape and history.
Again, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Today Today in the Exchange, we are asking this question, what is America's role in the world today? This is the question that NPR is examining all week with stations around the country as part of its election year, A Nation Engaged project. And we'd love to get you engaged on this issue this hour. So join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Wayne and Indy, let's go to our listeners. And Ken joins us from Antrim. Hi, Ken. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Well, we've been the world's cops, mostly on our own dime since World War II. And we can't do it alone, financially and morally and for many other reasons. It's time for the world's other nations to come to that realization and figure out that we're going to have to do something together.
Ken, thanks a lot for calling in. And boy, Wayne, we do hear this from a lot of folks. You know, we've been the world's cops for too long. Time for someone else to step it up.
I think Ken captures a sentiment that is very strong in politics today and has been for quite some time. You know, this idea of being the global policeman is really a problem. And a lot of voters are saying we've had enough. And this sort of fuels candidates like Trump who are questioning things like NATO. Even when voters in that same Pew survey, even when voters say that, you know, ISIS is the greatest threat, and 47% say it requires an overwhelming military response, right? That's boots on the ground. That same number, that same percentage says, but that's likely to increase terrorism more. That's likely to lead to other groups, right, rising up. So that's the conundrum that we're in. And I think that what Ken is pointing to is that when we face global challenges in the world, whether it's security or it's a global health crisis, something like that, a collective response, right? Countries coming together and addressing those issues as a group is, I think, the way a lot of voters, like Ken, I think, would prefer we go.
Well, and Ken, thanks for the call. And since you mentioned Donald Trump, Wayne, here's Mr. Trump earlier in the campaign when he caused waves by saying that the U.S. might want to pull back its commitment to NATO, arguing that this country already contributes more than it should. This interview from CNN.
Yes, because it's costing us too much money. And frankly, they have to put up more money. They're going to have to put some up also. We're paying disproportionately. It's too much. And frankly, it's a different world than it was when we originally conceived of the idea and everybody got together. But we're taking care of, as an example, the Ukraine. I mean, the countries over there don't seem to be so interested. We're the ones taking the brunt of it. So I think we have to reconsider, keep NATO, but maybe we have to pay a lot less toward the NATO itself.
Andy, what do you think? You alluded to this before, talking about World War One and World War Two. You know, there he is making the point, look, it's a different world. The U.S., as you said, used to be the only big guy on the block. Things have changed. And he's saying we need to reconsider some of these sort of post-World War Two alliances. That was a long time ago.
It was, and certainly the world has changed some ways for the better in that the Europe now certainly is much more on its feet than it was in the 1940s and 1950s and is able to, should be able to withstand economically a Russian threat. But at the same time, there is a point that you can be made about NATO is that they're militarily, they've relied on the United States to such a great extent that NATO without the United States, and particularly without Britain and the United States, it's essentially a hollow military threat. It's very difficult for all of the other countries of Europe to field even more than one tank battalion. So when you start talking about security threats with some of the countries within NATO and the EU, it becomes very problematic for where else are you going to look. And I think that's one of the reasons you're seeing European countries now getting very nervous about the United States, and just coming over here today, hearing that the Germans have scuttled a trade pact that was being negotiated with the United States because they're saying, you know what, you guys used to be our backer, you guys used to protect us. Now, if you're going to be pulling out, and we don't have anything else to, we can't protect ourselves almost. Dealing with the Russians becomes something that they have to think about quite differently than they did in the past.
You know, Wayne, in the kickoff piece to A Nation Engaged on NPR this morning, they quoted a Dartmouth College scholar, Stephen Brooks, who looks around the globe and chooses a region and asks students, okay, where should the U.S. pull back? And it's interesting, according to the piece, most students used to say Western Europe, sort of making the point that Donald Trump makes in that clip, which is, hey, they're wealthy countries, they're on their feet, why are we still backing them up?
That's a great question. I think what Donald Trump gets right in that quote and in his thoughts there is that the burden-sharing aspect of NATO, right, the cost of NATO hasn't been equitably split among the members. There's a greater capacity in this region than in, say, other regions. And in fact, after the Cold War, Europe drew down its military. They saved a lot of money, and because they overwhelmingly relied on the U.S. and the U.S. presence in Europe and U.S. expenditures. But Danny's right. The reality is NATO can't really go to war. NATO cannot fulfill its charter mission without the U.S. involvement. And you can get into all level of details, but that's the reality. The U.S. is NATO. So that's the part Donald Trump gets right. The problem is that the Western Alliance is still an important and relevant organization. If, for no other reason, Russia is doing interesting things there. Richard Haass is describing in his writings these days, he's the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, you know, this reemergence of great power competition. That's something we had stopped talking about a lot after the Cold War, and we have seen it sort of begin to bubble back up, not just between the U.S. and Russia, but in these days, especially between the U.S. and Russia.
Well, here's Hillary Clinton talking about the importance of NATO, and this came up in the primary, too, with Bernie Sanders. Here she is in a primary debate in April in New York, and you'll hear the CNN moderator break in.
NATO has been the most successful military alliance in probably human history. It has bound together across the Atlantic countries that are democracies, that have many of the same values and interests. And now we need to modernize it and move it into the 21st century to serve as that head of our defense operations in Europe when it comes to terrorism and other threats that we face.
Madam Secretary,
yes, of course, they should be paying more. But that doesn't mean if they don't, we leave, because I don't think that's in America's interest.
So again, there's that issue of, you know, should they be paying more, Andy?
Yeah, I think that listening to that clip, it points out the kind of the politically difficult position Hillary Clinton is in, because she's arguing something that makes, you know, you could certainly make a very strong case. It makes sense geopolitically and makes sense for the United States. But I think she's also arguing kind of last year's world. So when we talk about great power competition coming up, great power competition, by and large, throughout history, is the norm. Periods of cooperation are usually unusual, and they usually happen after one great power gets devastated by another great power, and then everybody's calm for a while. But that continually bubbles up. And we tend to live and see the world through what's happened in our lifetime or immediately before our lifetime. And again, this period post-World War II is really unique. There are a few times in history where one country has been as dominant as the United States has been economically and militarily. The norm is that there are going to be multiple countries that have various degrees of strength, and they all have different interests than the United States. And I think that's a problem, getting back to the public opinion aspect of that. The public in the United States thinks about U.S. interests, and we can't understand why the rest of the world just doesn't see it our way. but the rest of the world has their own very unique interests, and they conflict with the United States. So Clinton's in a difficult spot making an argument about something that really I think is past a little bit. NATO is an important, a hugely important alliance, but as it stands, it really does have to change because it doesn't reflect the way the world is now.
And Donald Trump's tapping into that, mm-hmm. saying, okay, this is, you know, 60, 70, however old NATO is, 50 years old. Maybe it is time for a different worldview. I'm so glad you mentioned people being shaped by the circumstances of under which they grew up. How about older versus younger, Wayne L'Esperance? Do we sort of have worldviews based on the events that shaped us, whether it's Vietnam or the Cold War or 9/11?
Sure. I remember teachers telling me about the time as kids, you know, hiding under their desks during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and how that very much affected their worldview.
Duck and cover.
I grew up in the 80s. I remember the evil empire speech. I remember President Reagan really painting a very stark picture of the then Soviet Union. My students that are coming in now were born in 1998, 1999. Their worldview is very different from mine, and I think they're going to have very different expectations and even values about how America ought to be in the world.
Well, we'll pick up on that after a short break and also dig into how Americans feel the role of this country is in terms of fighting terrorism, especially ISIS. So we'll tap into that in just a moment. You can join us too, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what is America's role in the world? How do you see it now? What do you think it should be? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. This week, NPR listeners across the country are examining this question. What is America's role in the world today? And we'd love to hear from you on that. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Wayne Lesperance, Andy Smith, before we go back to our listeners, Andy, I'd love your thoughts, too, on what Wayne was saying, how older versus younger voters might have very different answers to that question, what is America's role in the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think of my parents, the World War II generation. They remember World War II. They remember the horrors of the war, the bombing of the nuclear weapons. That shaped generations of thought, because those people that fought in World War II were the political and economic and social leaders of the country going through George H.W. Bush into the 1990s. Well, we've seen a shift since then to the baby boom generation. If you think what they were shaped by is, to a great extent, Vietnam.
So let's
and
not be interventionist.
Not be in,
let's
this,
pull back.
Pull back.
This is trouble.
Yeah, this is trouble. And so you see that sort of thing playing out. And I think to a great extent in Democratic politics, certainly with Obama, but also with Bernie Sanders. And now you're seeing Republicans kind of taking on a bit more of that isolationist role that they have historically had in the United States. So I think the generational differences that we see are not unusual. They're not going to be consistent, because each generation is going to be facing different foreign policy issues that shape their worldview. But you're going to see that difference, and it's going to be it's a sign of a good politician if they can understand those differences, particularly within their own parties, in order to build the political support to do anything about it. And I think we're in a very unusual situation right now, where I don't think there's strong support one way or the other for what the United States ought to be doing.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned the political parties, Andy, because Wayne, one scholar quoted in NPR's kickoff piece this morning, said there are two parties when it comes to foreign policy, but they are not the Republican and the Democratic Party. They are the isolationist party and the international party. And I thought that was really interesting. What do you think?
I think that's right. I think that's right, and I think it's increasingly true this particular cycle. We have a very interesting shift, I think. Donald Trump represents something that we haven't seen very often with Republican candidates, who typically embrace a very muscular foreign policy, an interventionist foreign policy, asserting American interests in the world and protecting them. In this particular race, I'm not sure that's true anymore. In fact, I think it's probably not true. And we see with Hillary Clinton someone who is comfortable with a muscular foreign policy, comfortable with the generals. There's lots of stories about trying to convince President Obama to ramp up a surge in Afghanistan early on, to use force more aggressively, more quickly in Syria, things like that while she was Secretary of State. So we've kind of turned things on their head, even to the point where there was a lot of discussion after the two conventions about the number of American flags you saw on the stages. And Democrats have really sort of, in many ways, this is going to be an unfortunate way to phrase it, but caught up with Republican shows of patriotism in their convention. All of this getting to this idea that a strong, muscular, active foreign policy is desirable. That's Hillary Clinton these days, not so much Donald Trump. So this Democrat versus Republican divide that we're used to, not so much anymore.
It's changed. Yeah. The New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd, I think it was, described them as Donald the Dove and Hillary the Hawk. So you're right, Wayne. It's different from what we often see with the two parties. What do you think, Andy?
Well, Trump is tapping into something, though, that has been there in Republican politics for more than 100 years. Certainly, you go back to World War I, Warren Harding in the election of 1920 was talking about the return to normalcy as opposed to Woodrow Wilson's interventionist and League of Nations involvement in World War I. Robert Taft, Mr. Republican, when he ran against Dwight Eisenhower in the 1952 Republican primaries, was talking about more of an isolationist foreign policy, kind of a fortress America. Pat Buchanan certainly tapped into this in the 1990s. Ron Paul was pushing this argument in his two runs in 2008 and 2012. So it's been there.
I remember that. He got lots of applause for that.
He did, especially among younger people. So it's been there. It's been a theme in the Republican politics, but it's never been the dominant theme, certainly since World War II in Republican politics.
Lots of people want to jump in on this question that we're asking this hour. What is America's role in the world? Tell us what you think. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email from Adam in Sandwich responding to our earlier caller who said we can't be the world's cop anymore. Adam says, we say we want to step back from being the world police, but will we be able to accept it when another power makes value judgments that differ from ours and refrain from intervening and delegitimizing the process? Thank you, Adam, for the email. What do you think, Wayne? That's the other side of the coin from what our first caller talked about.
The answer is no.
As long as we
have the capacity to resist, we will. I mean, there's a school of thought called realism in international politics that basically says that it's a dog-eat-dog world out there, and you don't want to use a silly phrase, you'd be caught wearing milk-bone underwear. You really want to be the toughest guy in the neighborhood.
Wait. What does that mean?
So it's a dog-eat-dog world. You don't want to be caught wearing milk-bone underwear. That's my simplification of a lot of sophisticated theory. The idea is that if you aren't the one making the decisions, then someone else is. And it's much more fun when you're in charge than having someone else impose their will on you. Now, that's, you know, a kind of a gross simplification, but that's the idea of this point of view, that the United States, you know, is in a position to have influence in the world. But beyond that, what both candidates are talking about is an interest-based foreign policy, avoiding wars of choice, avoiding doing things that compromise us in the world, but being active. This is especially true with Hillary Clinton, being active in the world when it's about protecting American interests abroad. And we have a lot of interests abroad.
Do you want to jump in, Andy?
I absolutely agree with what Wayne is saying there. But the U.S. and other countries historically have always had – somebody's been in this position, or if not, you have big problems in the world. But you can't shirk it. So the U.S. is the policeman of the world, not because it wants to be, but because we are the biggest guy. We have to do it. And the rest of the world is going to look to the United States. And when the United States doesn't fulfill that role – that's when things when a country doesn't fill that role, but it's expected to, that's when you start to see things go south very quickly. And I think that we're a little bit in that position right now. I think that some of the foreign policy problems that we're seeing in the rest of the world, the increasing aggression by Russia in both Crimea and in other parts of Ukraine, and rattling sabers against the Baltic countries, the increasing belligerence of China in the South China Sea and against its neighbors, and in the Middle East with Turkey and other countries not respecting what the United States is wanting to do, I think that's come about because we have pulled back. We haven't done things that we have done in the past, and other countries are going to fill in that power void. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. So does the United States – do we want the U.S. to be the police, the cop? We probably don't want us to. But if we're not, somebody else is going to do it, and we're not necessarily going to like that.
Adam, thank you very much for the email. You can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email like Adam did, exchange at nhpr.org. As we examine this question, what is America's role in the world today? Let's go to Mike in Berlin. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Go ahead, Mike.
I'm the guy I said earlier, I'm a Gulf War veteran, and a lot of us are Gulf War veterans. A lot of us have suffered multiple deployments, you know, and a lot of us are just tired of going back overseas, you know, to fight people who don't even want us there. And we come home, we end up messed up in our heads. We end up messed up physically, mentally, and we see all these refugees coming here. They're getting help, and us veterans, we have to fight just to get help here. And a lot of guys are just, you know, they don't believe in what they're doing anymore because it's just crazy.
So, Mike, yeah. if you were to answer that question, sounds like you would say America's role should be scaled back?
Yeah, that's what I think.
Too much of an impact on veterans.
We need veterans need help now, and we have to fight for everything. And I think a lot of my fellow veterans are just tired of fighting for everything.
You know, Mike, it's so good to hear from you. I really appreciate the call. And Wayne, you know, those engaged in the armed forces are exhausted with long wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I think one of the ways you can measure the greatness of a country is the way you treat the people that you put in uniform to defend it. And I think that I think Mike's point is spot on, that we have done a shameful job with our veterans in the aftermath of all of these conflicts. And I think his words are really important. I think probably one of the hardest things to understand from a policy perspective is why we end up doing things again and again and again in the same place. Iraq is a good example. And the answer is that the circumstances on the ground don't always lend themselves to neat conclusions, to neat, tidy endings. And that's what we experienced when Saddam Hussein remained in power after Desert Storm, Desert Shield. And now we're seeing it again with ISIS. Probably the biggest argument against an overwhelming military force against ISIS is it does nothing to change the underlying conditions that lead to the formation of a group like ISIS, just like ISIS came after an overwhelming military response was used against al-Qaeda. Unless we're prepared to drain that swamp, which is a much different kind of commitment than anything that we're used to or anything that the candidates are talking about, we are going to see this again and again and again. And guys like Mike, who've done their job, who've put on their country's uniform, who are sent into harm's way, are going to be asked to go back again and again. This is the nature of the challenge that we face.
Yeah, Mike, it's really good to hear from you. Thank you so much for calling in. Go ahead, Andy.
Again, this is not new or unique to the United States. I mean, you think about the Roman Empire did the same thing. And if you read some of the writings of Roman soldiers or descriptions about what they were going through, the same sorts of experiences were there. They're sent to foreign places. They're sent to fight. They don't know why they're there. They're dying. They're fighting for themselves and their colleagues rather than the country after a while.
The local people don't want them there.
They don't want them there. They're seen as occupiers. And it's in a lot of the same places that the Romans were fighting and hitting the barriers of their civilization that we're seeing the same issues happening today. And I think that's one of the problems that I think we have with our political leadership is that we sell the public to go into some sort of large-scale military activity or foreign engagement with the idea that if we do this, we're going to make the world safe for democracy. You name the slogan that we're going to end this problem. But the human problems don't end. These are fundamental to the nature of kind of the human animal and the cultural differences that we have in different places. You know, it's always that fight for fight and competition for resources, expanding power, et cetera, that they don't end. And those points that Samuel Huntington talks about, the barriers between civilizations, are going to be constantly bumping up and having conflicts here. So I think our political leadership really does a poor job in selling us that this is going to be an easy thing. We go in, boots on the ground, we'll take care of this problem, and it'll go away. It won't, because it's a much more fundamental human cultural problem that we're dealing with in these areas.
Well, and in a couple minutes, I'll play some clips of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump on how they say they would deal with the threat of ISIS and other terrorist groups. But let's go back to our listeners for a moment. And Don is in Portsmouth. Hi, Don. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura.
Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to talk about our foreign affairs budget. It concerns me greatly that typically when U.S. citizens are asked what percentage of our budget is spent on international affairs, they usually say about 20 to 25%. When asked what it should be, they usually say about 10%, when in fact it's actually less than 1% of our overall budget. And it's my opinion and that of a lot of military veterans and international business persons that, you know, that foreign aid and the confluence of foreign aid with our own homeland security and economic development is critical. So I ask the speakers to comment on
so
that.
So, Don, you're talking about foreign aid, not military spending, because that's much greater.
It is. And I'm actually talking about our international affairs budget. So that includes foreign aid, and it also includes the entire budget for our embassies abroad. So, yeah, I'm talking about foreign affairs versus the military that mostly you've been talking about this morning.
Okay,
it's only 1% of our budget.
Thank you very much for calling in. Wayne, what do you think? And I have another question for you after that. But
Don's exactly right. I mean, if let's separate out defense spending from foreign affairs budget, it is less than 1%. I think the last time I checked, Americans spend more money on dog food than we spend on foreign aid. And when you look inside those numbers, we overwhelmingly concentrate that aid to two countries, Egypt and Israel. So it's
still Egypt and Israel.
It's certainly a huge issue. And, you know, at the end of the day, that foreign affairs budget, which is very controversial with voters, is influence. It's our ability to sort of spread American influence and ideas in the world. It's everything from encouraging students to come to the United States and study from other countries, learn what it's like to be in the United States, to sending Americans abroad. It's all kinds of other things. It's certainly a fair point that we don't really invest in public diplomacy in a way that we ought to.
Andy, every once in a while this comes up and people say we need to invest more in what Wayne calls public diplomacy to sort of explain who we are and what we're all about. And I remember President Obama a couple years ago called for a surge in troops in Afghanistan, but also a civilian surge. Remember that, of sort of road builders and teachers and so forth. So I wonder what you think about that.
I think that Wayne is absolutely right, and Dawn's right, that we don't spend that much money on it. But the problem that we see is it's very easy for people in politics to point out the problems when money is invested going to some dictator in some country, because a lot of the money that we invest in countries is essentially bribery for the governments of those countries to do what we want them to do. Not the people of the country, but the governments of those countries. And a lot of these are not really, you know, they're not Jeffersonian Democrats in a lot of these places. So I think it was President Mubarak of Egypt once said that the U.S. foreign policy in foreign aid involves sending poor people's money from wealthy countries to wealthy people in poor countries, that it goes to line the pockets of a lot of dictators rather than going to help the rank and file people in those countries, and which doesn't solve the problem.
Wayne?
Just think about our last two callers. Mike saying that we need to spend more on our veterans. We need to take care of our veterans coming home. And Dawn saying we need to spend more overseas. I mean, this is the kind of conflict we see in politics. They're both right. But this is the, you know, tough political decisions leaves there's only so much pie to go around.
Well, and it gets back to that very early poll question that we talked about. You know, how much should the U.S., quote, solve its own problems and let other countries take care of their own? Or how much should the U.S. be out there? Dawn, thank you for the call. Let's go to Mark in Portsmouth. Hi, Mark. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for the opportunity to chat. So I was just hoping that we could maybe talk about how the U.S. might be involved in climate change mitigation, given the Paris Climate Summit and our inability to put forth a really solid policy that met the goals. Are we going to hinder this, or are we going to move it forward?
So, Mark, to answer that question that we're asking today, what is America's role in the world today? What would you say?
Personally, I think that we need to step back if we're not going to be countries that actually invest in it. There are countries that are carbon neutral already. There are ones that have way more robust plans than we do, but we don't really let them have the same voice that we do. And when we have to try and subsidize some of the developing countries, I don't think we're going to be actually pushing it forward like we need to.
Mark, thanks a lot for calling in. You know, Wayne, some people do feel that climate change is a big foreign policy issue, whether it's, you know, negotiations, as we saw in Paris, or the difficulty that some countries are going to have with climate change. You know, their water supply is drying up and that creates turmoil and unrest and so forth.
This is a question that really breaks down across party lines or, you know, in partisan terms. I think it was that Pew poll that had some data on this that pointed to, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but pointed to Democrats identifying climate change as being a big issue, a foreign affairs issue, and Republicans not registering very much at all. They would point to the danger of illegal immigration, I believe, in that same poll. So I guess the answer to some extent is it depends on who we elect to be our next president as to what role we'll have over the next 4 years in global climate change. But I'd also say that generally I'm not sure the American people are as engaged on that as an issue. And maybe Andy knows in terms of how we rank that issue overall. I just don't think that resonates with folks the way a lot of other issues do.
Yeah, it's a hard push because any kind of environmental issue, and you can put climate change, you can put clean water, clean air, all of these sorts of things. If you don't see it directly, it's hard to get very concerned about it. And issues about climate tend to be near the bottom of the most important problems that people see facing the country.
Coming up, we'll talk a little bit more about how Americans view the threat of ISIS, how the presidential candidates say they would address it, and we'll keep taking your questions and comments. So stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what is America's role in the world? That's the question NPR listeners around the country are examining this week as part of the Nation Engage project. And let's hear from you on this question. What do you think America's role in the world should be? Call in 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Wayne Lesperance, Andy Smith, let's go right back to our listeners. And John's in Manchester. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I think I'm about as far polar opposite from Donald Trump's opinions as anyone can be possibly. And well, one thing he gets right is the funding problem. And you would have many more Americans on board if we took care of domestic issues here at home. Instead, it seems our foreign policy does the doing for big oligarchs and international companies and not really for the people. When we look over to Europe and we look to Israel and we see they have universal health care for all their citizens and housing for their citizens and things that we don't guarantee here, and as our quality of life gets lower and lower at the lower 50% of this country, people are not on board for throwing more money overseas when international oligarchs refuse to tax their own people.
So, John, you're saying you don't, you know, not a fan of Donald Trump, but happen to agree with him in this instance.
Yes. Well, again, just as an example, Israel has more billionaires than at any point in history right now. They don't tax their people anywhere close to what we tax our upper citizens at. And we barely tax our upper citizens enough, in my opinion, here.
Okay. So, John, I'm going to let you go, but I wonder what you guys think. Wayne?
Well, I think he's captured, you know, a lot of where that support for Donald Trump comes from. By the way, that's where those Bernie folks were at as well. The support of corporate interests and corporate America at the expense of the little guy is just unfair and in their mind. And so he's kind of tapped into it. I would go a step further. I'd say that, you know, the United States still remains a preeminent power in the world economically, militarily, in terms of higher education and in so many other ways. But where the potential for weakness for the United States is, the decline that people like to talk about, is internally. It's the threat that is within. It's the things that this caller is talking about, you know, quality of education, shrinking middle class, debt. Our institutions are increasingly less and less popular. So you have our infrastructure. This lack of investment domestically has consequences for our standing in the world. And I think that's the argument for why we ought to spend some more at home. But as I said at the top of the show, it's a bit of a false distinction to think that there is there and here. They are very much interrelated.
Well, and Donald Trump, we played a clip of him earlier in this campaign season, kind of making John's point, why are we spending all this money on NATO defense? Let's have them contribute more. A little bit later in the campaign, though, Mr. Trump changed his views on that, given what he said was NATO's renewed commitment to fight ISIS. Let's hear a little bit on that. This is from Donald Trump's foreign policy speech in August.
My administration will aggressively pursue joint and coalition military operations to crush and destroy ISIS, international cooperation to cut off their funding, expanded intelligence sharing, and cyber warfare to disrupt and disable their propaganda and recruiting. Their recruiting is taking place right now, and they're setting records. It's got to be stopped.
Now, earlier in the speech, Mr. Trump did say that he was praising NATO for going after ISIS and saying that he had, again, changed his thinking on the U.S. and how strongly it should be supporting NATO. But getting to what he said, Andy Smith, you know, it's tricky because we think about problems over there and then some of those over theres seem to come here. What do you pull out of what Donald Trump said in terms of his approach towards stopping ISIS?
Well, I think that he's indicating that it seems that NATO has woken up to the problems of the threat of terrorism because they're seeing it in their own shores, in bombings in Belgium and France, you know, we're seeing in Turkey in particular being on the front line of that as a NATO partner. But it also points out some of the problems that these NATO countries have. So NATO, or Turkey, for example, is fighting multiple kinds of terrorism, and they're trying to make a judgment of which one of these guys they have an alliance with. Do they want to maybe support the ISIS a little bit because they're fighting the Kurds, which they have long-standing problems with Kurds in Turkey. So we tend to think of what Trump is saying about ISIS. Certainly it's something that the Western world is seeing now as ISIS is a big problem. But you know, they can be an interesting ally for other people in the world who don't necessarily see them as the main problem, but see other things as major problems. But Trump's, I think, talking about NATO, again, is getting back to the idea that they're starting to see the world the way we see it. So if we think ISIS is bad and now NATO countries are starting to see ISIS is bad, they must be on board and we're okay with them again.
Well, what you don't hear in that clip, Wayne, is Donald Trump saying boots on the ground.
That's right. I mean, we talked a little bit earlier about this sort of more dovish approach to foreign policy. It's an interesting problem that he has. If you look at NATO just at the balance sheet, you say, wow, this is a terrible deal for us, right? Why are we spending so much money and what do we get in return for that? But then I think Mr. Trump began getting the briefings that he needs, and he started to hear about, well, here's what NATO's actually doing. And more importantly, they save us from having to do certain things. Now we're keeping American boots off the ground and not such a bad deal after all. And so I guess at the end of the day, foreign policy is incredibly complex. If you don't have a fairly sophisticated understanding of the nature of the challenges, what Andy said about shifting alliances and, you know, temporary allies, that's part of the deal. And you've got to be up for that in terms of dealing with the world. I think Trump is coming along, and I think you're seeing his policies begin to, you know, I'm not sure a full-blown change, but certainly evolve a bit. Around things like NATO.
Well, and Hillary Clinton has also, of course, talked about what her approach toward ISIS would be. Let's hear a little bit from Secretary Clinton's speech shortly after the Orlando nightclub attack in June.
The attack in Orlando makes it even more clear. We cannot contain this threat. We must defeat it. And the good news is that the coalition effort in Syria and Iraq has made recent gains in the last months. So we should keep the pressure on ramping up the air campaign, accelerating support for our friends fighting to take and hold ground, and pushing our partners in the region to do even more.
So again, there you hear coalition, air campaign, support for our friends. No one is saying send in overwhelming force. It sounds like, Andy, that that's just a place that candidates don't want to go right now.
Well, again, we are coming off, and we're still engaged in two ongoing longest wars in U.S. history in Afghanistan and Iraq. And if you put the Desert Storm as part of that war in Iraq, it's been going on for, you know, going on near 30 years. And there isn't an appetite among Americans to put U.S. troops much of anywhere. Now, we talk about ISIS going after ISIS's newest threat, and we have political leaders, you know, actually increasing concern about that because we're in a political environment. But I think that she's going to have a hard sell convincing people to put our troops in harm's way when our veterans don't want to do it. The military, we always have this idea that the military in the United States really wants to go out and do this stuff. It's usually not the military leaders that want to do it. It's political leaders, because political leaders get political gain out of this. Military leaders deal with the problems.
Well, and they often, the political leaders, especially these days, Wayne, have zero experience in terms of serving in the military. We've talked earlier about how disengaged most of the country's top leaders are now from that actual experience.
Well, that's right. So no direct experience having served or, you know, been involved in the decision making about sending troops into harm's way. And their experiences, as Andy said, the last, you know, decades of the bad news that comes with overseas deployment, putting troops in harm's way. So I think there's a lot that counts against the phrase boots on the ground by any of these candidates. And I also think Hillary Clinton has a long memory. And I think she knows that in 2008, this was a big problem for her. So there's a tremendous reluctance there.
Her support for Iraq in 2008.
That's right.
Andy, go ahead.
Yeah, you think of throughout U.S. history, military leaders have been fairly common as presidents. But the last military leader, the real military leader that we had as a president, was Dwight Eisenhower in the 1950s. We have not had somebody who's had that direct high-level engagement with the military as a political leader in the United States for an awfully long time. And I think it shows some of the drift and the disconnect that you seem to get sometimes between what we want to do politically and what is capable, what we're capable of militarily.
And George W. Bush was,
H.W. Bush. We've had a lot of people that have served, but it's very different between being the guy who's being told to do something and the person who's making the decisions to tell people what it is that they have to do.
Well, lots of commentary from our listeners. Again, on this question that we're asking today, what is America's role in the world today? You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Lots of emails, guys, that I want to share with you. Here's one from Pete in Derry. Please ask your guests to comment on my perception that referring to the U.S. as the, quote, world's policeman, in many ways misrepresents us as operating in an oh-so-noble protecting the community image. In reality, Pete says, so many of the U.S. military activities overseas have been primarily in our own economic and hegemonic and ideological interests. And he says, very often contrary to noble, in all caps, from Pete. I'm sure your guests can cite many of these, especially in Central and South America. Not policemen, Pete says, but palace guards or the Lord's army. Wow, Pete, thank you so much for the email. What do you think, Wayne?
Well, I think the United States usually acts in its own self-interest, and I don't think that comes as a surprise to anyone. I mean, that's what a country is supposed to do. Now, whether that's good or bad, I'll leave it to Pete and others to decide. But I think at the end of the day, the U.S. uses its military, uses its influence in the world to assure its continued existence first and foremost, but then to enhance its interests.
And here's an email from Mark in Madison who says, to what extent do you feel that our policies are driven by the interests of big business? Mark, thanks for the email. Andy, go ahead.
Yeah, one of the things we haven't talked about today is trade as a foreign policy issue. And that's was very important in the Democratic primary. And it's, I think, likely to come up during the general election between Trump and Clinton over TPP. So the trade issue. So we think we negotiated a free trade agreement, the TPP. But any sort of a free trade agreement that has to be kept secret in Congress and people aren't allowed to look at it and take pictures and comment on it, and it's thousands of pages long, doesn't really sound like a free trade agreement. It is an agreement between business interests in the United States and business interests in other parts of the country. This isn't new. This is what's been going on for thousands of years. Business is the way, you know, business, however you think of it, is the way that countries get stronger and wealthier and people make more money. But it is absolutely a problem. I just one quote that I love to use in these sorts of times is Benjamin Disraeli talking about England in the 19th century, saying England doesn't have allies, England has interests. And I think that's very much the case for the United States.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Mark. And here's another one from Mike in New London, who says, times have changed. We need to focus on our own citizens in need and our own security before we take on the world's problems. Mike says we need to intervene when our interests are threatened, of course. But solving all the world's problems is not our responsibility. Mike says we should have an effective, well-funded military to protect those interests and intervene in places where the conditions cause people to flee their homelands. But bringing them here is not the answer. Mike, thank you so much for the email. Wayne, picking up on that last point, this is another big debate, I think, in many countries in terms of their own role in the world, including this one. And that's, what responsibility does this country have to accept people who are fleeing their homelands, refugees from all over the world, sure, including right now, Syria?
So, I mean, we have a long history of doing that, you know, of accepting folks who have come from war-torn countries and finding a home for them here. But clearly, in the aftermath of what's going on or what's ongoing in Syria, we see what's happening in Europe, and there's a lot of concern. We're concerned about ISIS. We're concerned about infiltrators. We're concerned about all of these things, that somehow those conflicts over there are going to end up here. And because we're nice and we want to help people out who are suffering. So I think he's right. This is certainly an issue that Americans are concerned of. In that Pew poll, we said a little bit earlier that this is something that Republicans in particular are very worried about, that somehow we're letting in the wolves in sheep's clothing by an expanded immigration or refugee policy.
Mike, thanks for the email. Go ahead, Andy.
I think the United States has a long history of accepting refugees, but we often do it for political reasons. So if you think about some of the specific policies of the United States, we're happy to accept refugees from, say, Cuba or the Soviet Union during the Cold War, because that was a good political PR for the United States, but we were much less willing to take on, say, Jewish refugees in the onset of World War II. We have a mixed bag record on our willingness to accept refugees.
Here's an email from Tom in Exeter. Real interesting point, Tom. Thank you. He says, I don't like that the U.S. is involved so heavily overseas, but I think we need to be involved. Look at the following, Tom says. In the 1980s, President Reagan supplied arms to the Afghan Mujahideen. Decades later, we're fighting the Taliban. In the 1990s, President Clinton tried to stay out of the Bosnia War. A genocide followed before NATO fully engaged. Tom says President George W. Bush invaded Iraq. That allowed al-Qaeda to strengthen and grow. President Obama has been reluctant to fully engage ISIS. They grew and now terrorize France and other countries. Tom says, my point is we can't be all in or all out. We need a president who will imply intelligence and balance in their decision making. Thank you, Tom, for the email. Wayne, very thoughtful.
I absolutely agree. It's a smart set of comments, but it also gets to, I think, another challenge that, you know, foreign policy isn't something you if you can avoid, you do on the fly. It's something that you need to think about long-term implications. You need to think about more than just the next 10 days, and often that's all you've got. And I think that to the extent that it's possible, that the United States ought to be focusing on its interests and saying we're going to get involved, or we have to, reluctantly, perhaps a reluctant sheriff, I'm stealing a book title here, as opposed to a world's police, gathering others to go with us. The all-in part ought to be all-in in terms of the international community responding, not just the United States. But Tom's exactly right. These are complex issues.
Well, and the other thing that he points out, and I think it's a great point, Andy, is you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, you know, you may push this policy button or that policy button, but you don't know how the other actors are going to respond. They've got their own ideas.
We haven't really had a overarching military policy in the United States since containment after World War II with the Soviet Union. I think that's part of the issue that we have here. We haven't come with a bipartisan policy strategy for the United States.
Well, Andy Smith, great to see you. Good luck with the new school year. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Andy Smith, director of the UNH Survey Center and an associate professor of political science at UNH. And same to you, Wayne. Hats off for a good academic year as it opens.
Thanks, Laura.
Wayne Lesperance, interim dean of undergraduate programs and a professor of political science at New England College. Remember, our conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.